Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, or as I should say to our friends in Wisconsin, I think, good afternoon. My name is Paul Johnson. I'm Deputy Director of LSE, and I'm pleased to welcome you all here at London School of Economics and our colleagues over at the University of Wisconsin for today's lecture. A lecture to be given by Laura Lee Martin, Chief Financial Officer of Jones Lang LaSalle, on the globalization of real estate services. This is the third in a series of LSE lectures on real estate, which have been taking place this term. The first was by Francis Sulway, Chief Executive of Land Securities, Britain's largest property company. And the second was by Harry Platt, CEO of the Workspace Group, which is one of Britain's most profitable property groups and one of its less conventional ones in terms of market strategy. These lectures are an indication of some of the work that LSE is doing in the general area of real estate. As you, many of you here will know, LSE has a significant presence in education and research in real estate issues, particularly, of course, focusing on financial and economic aspects. And that's particularly fitting given that we are located in the heart of London, which is the real estate capital for Europe. And of course, we are located in some of London's most expensive real estate, though, as colleagues, staff and students at LSE know, we are also located here in some of the most dilapidated real estate in the centre of London. LSE now runs an extremely impressive master's programme in real estate economics and finance. This year we had some 300 applications for just 20 student places in that course, and have therefore, of course, recruited 20 of the ablest students from around the world to learn about real estate economics and finance. Those 20 students at present are studying, but no doubt in two or three decades' time they'll be running some of the major real estate companies in the world and will all be very, very wealthy individuals. The small amount of money you will have paid in fees to study this course will appear to be nothing compared to the huge salaries you'll be earning in the future. Let me turn to tonight's lecture by Laura Lee Martin on the globalization of real estate services. Laura Lee Martin is Chief Financial Officer of Jones Lang LaSalle, which is one of the world's biggest intermediaries and service providers in the world of real estate. And over the last 10 to 15 years, it has, like many organizations in the real estate business, become a truly international company. So international, in fact, that a couple of weeks ago, it appointed an LSE alumna, Sheila Penrose, as chair of its board of directors. Again, evidence that an LSE degree can take you to the very top of the world of real estate. Laura Lee Martin is chief financial officer for group, but her experience in real estate extends well beyond her time with Jones Lang LaSalle. She's just been telling me that she has, in one way or another, with a number of different companies, GE Capital and Heller Financial, she's operated in the world of real estate for a number of decades, three decades, and has seen, therefore, the real estate business go through a number of cycles, a number of, if not booms and busts, certainly rises and falls. And I think grappling with some of the difficulties, some of the cyclical instability of real estate is always one of the challenges for people working in the industry. And I think that's in part a challenge that she's going to be talking to us about tonight. So without further ado, Laura Lee Martin on the globalization of real estate services.
Thank you very much. All right. My topic this evening is definitely going to be about globalization, but more specifically, it's about real estate in changing times. Or put another way, as a real estate professional, and for many of you soon-to-be real estate professionals, the world that we are operating in is definitely changing, and changing at an increasingly rapid pace. In my almost 30 years in the real estate business, the one premise that I was taught from the very beginning and continue to follow is that because real estate is a long-term asset, think about every single thing you do about it as a long-term decision. So long-term leases, long-term purchases, long-term financing. And it makes you have to think fairly carefully about your decisions. Just to give you some ideas, clearly decisions change landscapes. You hear about cutting down rainforests and it can't grow back. I'm a little bit older than you. You're now listening to the remix of the Joni Mitchell song that said they paved paradise and put up a parking lot. But clearly, it's a permanent change many times. If you think about why zoning came to be, it's because somebody thought that you need to think about these impacts as much longer term in their nature. And clearly, we were taught that real estate doesn't move, and therefore, again, your decisions are relatively permanent. Also, real estate has created visions, and it's created legacies. Whether you think about some of the great forefathers that managed to think about putting open spaces in parks in major cities, or if you think about how new areas were created, such as a La Défense in France, where they put really the transport system there first, or if you think about my town, Chicago, which is known as a major commuting town and one of the few 24/7 cities where people live downtown in the United States because of that transportation system, there is clearly legacies that go with it. But if there is not a bigger contrast that one could have to deal with, just think about long-term decisions, and now it's operating in an environment where those decisions are going to be challenged at an increasingly rapid pace. Whether you think about the fact that definitely globalization, which is driving the whole offshoring, whether you think about technology, which is changing the way we think about space, whether you think about diversity of workplaces, all of these factors are definitely making us have to think harder about those long-term decisions. I don't know if you've had the chance to see the new book out called Confronting Reality by Larry Bossidy and Ram Charan. But their premise is that if business ignores the pace of change, it will be in a desperate state. And they list three reasons for that fast change. Number one is definitely globalization. Number two is worldwide overinvestment and overcapacity in almost all areas because of the availability of risk capital. And that has caused most of the cycles that we know in real estate. And I'll talk about the third in a little bit, but if we also throw in their technology, clearly it's a different environment that we have to deal with about those long-term decisions. I think this is a great quote when you think about the new world of real estate, and that is the ability to define what may happen in the future and to choose among the alternatives lies at the heart of contemporary society. I think one of the reasons that I personally have such an incredible passion about real estate is that real estate professionals and the real estate industry have proven time and time again how quickly they can adapt their long-term decisions to this rapid-paced change. Why do I think that? Well, first of all, one of the first things you think about in terms of real estate professionals is confidence. Well, you have to have confidence to start long-term projects. Clearly, the great cathedrals even of Europe would never have been started if someone didn't have enough confidence to think that it's worthwhile starting and when it will be finished. If you think about the innovation that real estate has brought just to architecture, again, in Chicago, known for the skyscraper, it wasn't the fact that architecture hadn't figured out how to go high. Clearly, the Gothic arch had figured that out a long time ago. But to think about stacking space and then bringing in the elevator such that people were willing to go up and down, great innovation. or if you think about design, and I'm throwing out things that maybe some of you are going to choose as careers, because I do think there's adaption all over in the real estate space. But if you think about design and just think about what happened to our quality of living and the home when someone thought about bringing the outhouse as an in-house with the advent of plumbing, clearly a major change. And most of my real estate background prior to Jones Lang LaSalle was in the financing arena. And if there's ever been a change that has come to an industry that just eats capital, it's been the financing world when you think about the REIT phenomena and the securitization phenomena, which has brought really the whole CMBS and the other aspects to the residential community. I have to give you just a little advertising around Jones Lang LaSalle, but I do think it sets a premise of where I'm going to go. Jones Lang LaSalle, and I've been with the firm now 3 years, but Jones Lang LaSalle has been Jones Lang LaSalle for 5 years. And it was really the union of two very strong companies, LaSalle Partners, headquartered in Chicago, who specialized in the corporate business and the money management business. And their clients said, we need your help overseas. And Jones Lang Wooten, who had really established their headquarters in London and spread all the way to Asia, that had an incredible investor base that said, I need you to take me to the United States. And it was that globalization demand of clients, and that's really what happens in a service business. It's what the clients need and value. That globalization is what created Jones Lang LaSalle. We do have a dominant global platform. We are in 34 countries. That's 100 major real estate markets. And we serve those markets with over 8,000 professionals. One of the largest property management and facility management businesses in the world, with 800 million square feet under management. I think that's 80 million square meters. You can tell I'm American. One of the largest money management firms in the world, and I'm going to talk about investment in real estate in a little bit. One of the leading project management business, and really top-notch research around the globe. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this next slide. I could. As the chief financial officer of Jones Lang LaSalle, I talk to the investors that buy Jones Lang LaSalle stock, and I can spend hours on this chart. So. But what's really important, again, is telling you why Jones Lang LaSalle came to be, and that's that integrated global service piece that is valued by clients. And just to demonstrate it is the client base. And if there's anything to take away from this, it's why, again, that globalization was so key. Because you're going to see corporates on here from all parts of the world, whether it's from Asia or Europe or the U.S. multinationals that wanted global services, and huge investors in real estate that, again, wanted to go global. Our research, and Rosemary Feenan's with me tonight, she's actually led our research on winning cities. But our research has said, yes, there are lots of factors that happened in the past that made real estate success, cities a success, and there will be factors in the future that will mean that some real estate will win over others. And I think as you think about your real estate, those are things you want to keep in the back of your mind, that there are factors that make a big difference in how wealth will be created. But let me talk about some of the change that is going on. When I entered the workforce, and I think some of you are going to be doing that shortly, I was coming in with a mass of people with a work and labor force that was growing at over 2.5% a year. And not only that, you added the women that were coming into the workforce that made up a part of that, but a very different dynamic than if you talk about what is real estate going to be when it's growing at less than 0.5%. It's going to be a different demand for office space. It's a different demand for housing. It's a different demand for retail because of how much spend can go on. So I'm going to talk about different factors to think about, first, in the business world relative to real estate, and second, into the investment world relative to real estate. So let's talk a little bit more about these macro factors. The U.S. is still going to see some pretty healthy growth as we look out into the year 2050, but mostly probably because immigration continues to drive the U.S. and there's space to put them there. But when we move into Europe, clearly you see the population growth is flat to down. And when you go to a major economy like a Japan and actually see less people, you have to start thinking about what that's going to mean for your real estate in the future. Let's compound it a little bit further. And I know you've seen these statistics, but when you see them on charts, they always surprise me. And that is this first one, 1990, and this is, you know, the labor force. If you can see the charts, what you'll see is that sort of the peak of age is that sort of 29 to 35. Nice, vibrant age to get into the workforce. Clearly, in the U.S., when all of a sudden it's the 50 to 55-year-old group that is dominating, again, what is that going to do to the real estate of the future? Let's go to that mature market of a Germany or a Europe and see if it doesn't become even more profound. So you layer these demographics onto declining populations, and you really have to start thinking about your real estate and what you want to do in the future. Then let's look around the world. There's no question that Asia still has the dominant population. It's going to stay dominant. But when I saw this chart, it surprised me because the growth in Africa, we don't even think about Africa. As a matter of fact, Jones Lang LaSalle has a very limited, if almost no presence in Africa. And yet when you look at population growth, there's something out there that says, oh, maybe I better rethink. And then you think about where innovation comes from and get back to that creativity of real estate. And you start to look at the factors. And the dynamic of a China passing the U.S. As a matter of fact, it's more dramatic than that. Right now, China has as many students enrolled in college as the United States and the European Union combined. In 2004, this year, they're going to produce five times the number of engineers that the U.S. does. So again, that's a little scary. But add to that that China is spending $60 billion on R&D a year. So they have the engineers, and they're going to spend the money. And that amount of R&D is only exceeded by the U.S. and Japan. So again, when you start to think about what's going to go forward, and now remember I'm going into the business world, think about what that's going to mean. Business has one key factor behind it, and that it's seeking to grow profits. And it's going to do that in one of two ways. It's going to look for places it can produce revenues, or it's going to do what it's really done in the last few years when around the world revenues were growing in very few places, and that it's going to look to reduce costs. I think most of you know what has happened in the manufacturing world. Again, being from Chicago, the heart of the manufacturing in the Midwest of the U.S., when you're comparing an average cost of $44,000 for a manufacturing position in the U.S., and we have a choice to send it down to Mexico City for $4,000 or less, the decisions become pretty quick as to why all of a sudden those jobs and that real estate and everything transferred to another location. Now you say, well, pretty adaptable. Chicago quickly adapted, and I'm sure you've got the same thing in London and other parts of the world, and became a service economy. Showed how clever we were. Unfortunately, the service chart looks exactly the same. Take a New York, take a Brussels, compare that to a Mumbai and a Manila. Now you say, well, that's different. It was easy to create manufacturing plants. That service sector takes a lot more talent. But remember, they've decided that not only are they going to produce the people and the talent at a lower cost, but they're going to do it with educated and talented people, changing one more factor on the business world, and the business world touches all aspects of real estate. As a CFO, clearly, I've been focusing on cost. All my peers have focused on cost. And 50% of CFOs will say that real estate is in their top three of doing business. It's one of the premises that Jones Lang LaSalle sells, and that is you can outsource your real estate to us and we can save you 20% in that cost. And that's been a major growth for us, even in the downturn of the recession. But people, if they're not in the third, they're in the one and two. So now all of a sudden you combine real estate and cost of people, and you have to pay attention. So all of a sudden there's offshoring. yes, it's going to happen. They're going to go from the Silicon Valley or from a Stockholm into a Bangalore. It has been happening. And what's interesting to me, if you think again about the pace of change that I'm talking about on the business world, GE, and I'm an alum of GE, less than 30 years ago, GE came up with the concept of offshoring, a very short period of time when you think about the history of business. In less than 30 years, you can find almost every single major corporate having some aspect of offshoring happening in another market. As a matter of fact, the FT had, I think as I was flying home last Friday, they had an article that said 53% of all corporate companies in the UK are considering or already have offshored or outsourced something. So again, it's something that is going at a very rapid pace. And if you've built your real estate, assuming the world is going to be the same, you can be quite surprised. We, as Jones Lang LaSalle, provide services to many of the clients that you see on here. I was recently in our Mumbai and Bangalore office, and it's amazing to go down these streets and see one after another of really class A facilities. They started as call centers. Now they have a Fidelity who goes to a much higher level of sophistication around a money management capability. And what's really terrifying is they can take that real estate and they work it 24 hours. Accenture runs three shifts through the facilities that we manage for them on a daily basis. That real estate becomes incredibly productive. And that 24/7 with them running around the globe means that all of a sudden they're of value to somebody, someplace in the world at all times. Big political part of the campaign. Obviously, it looks like it's over now with the results of the election. But it's interesting, if you look at the statistics, the impact of offshoring on the U.S. has barely started. You know, it's less than a million jobs. Now, that's a lot of jobs. But when you start talking about over 3 million jobs, you're talking about transferring entire cities. As a matter of fact, one of the statistics that I read was that you could take every single job in the United States offshore to China, and China would still have surplus labor. Now, clearly, all those jobs can't go, but it does tell you about some of the dynamics of what we potentially are going to see in the future. And clearly, there is a difference in cost that is pretty extreme. What I always find interesting is many of these are locations I've never even heard of or not been to, and I view myself as a pretty well-traveled person, but when you get to a Dalian, I'm not quite sure where that is, but clearly what I do know is none of these are in the United States or Europe. That is a fact. Now you can say that you know, Europe has done less than the rest, and part of it has been because in India, clearly the language is very supportive to a UK or a US because the English is there. But the power of the EU, where all of a sudden, and I should go back to the chart because you'll see all of these cities that are up here, we're at that low cost right with India. You can put outsourcing and offshoring into a Budapest or a Prague, and they can deliver all the languages that Europe has, and again, they can do it at a much lower cost. So I've talked about the cost side of business, and clearly what I'm trying to do is wake you up to the fact, going back to, you're going to be taught that you're going to make decisions around real estate. They do have a long-term impact, but you've got to figure out how to be adaptable and quick because the change that is going on in the future is much more dramatic than what it's been in the past. But let's talk a little bit now about revenues, because that's the second part of the equation on how business makes profit grow. Again, going back to the book I mentioned at the beginning, Confronting Reality, it was globalization, way too much availability of capital, and the third factor changing the world was the power of the consumer. And those three is what's driving change. So let's look now at the power of the consumer. China. Consuming 50% of the world's cement, 36% of its steel, 30% of its coal. It produced 4.4 million vehicles in 2003. That's a 35% growth over the prior year. I'm going to talk in a little bit about how much they're buying of those, because right now it is the world's largest producer after the U.S. Japan, and Germany when you think about the major cars, at least as we think about them in the States. And the fact that today China can produce just about everything 30 to 50%. If you've known anything about Six Sigma, you know, they always talk about go after costs and take 50% out. Well, China's just sort of Six Sigma the world, I think, here, because they figured out how to take 50% out of everything. And that's going to have an impact on every single company worldwide. And so they're going to have to think and rethink every aspect of their business. And real estate, remember, is in the top three costs. The Finance Asia said that China could become the workshop of the world in the same way that Lancashire, England, had more machines installed in 1830 than the rest of the world combined. That's the kind of impact we're talking about in terms of major capabilities. The business world is recognizing it. If you look at foreign direct investment, and I apologize if these are a little small for you, but they start blipping up quite dramatically in 1993. And since that period, since 1996, $40 billion have gone into China every single year from outside China coming in, investing in China. What I think is very interesting, that the chart at the bottom shows these big, where the money is going in it. And all of these cities are in China, okay? All I can tell you is I haven't heard of probably more than three of them. You've got cities like Zhejiang, Fujian, maybe some of the people that are from China can pronounce these better, Shandong or Hebei. But huge amounts of money are going into places we've never heard of. Clearly, the business world has recognized it, and it's going to change the footprint. Not only that, in a subtle way, when we've thought that the Asia was in a downturn since the currency defaults out of Russia starting in 1998, despite that, China has had a growth rate consistently above the rest of the world, even back in before that period of 1996. It just slowed it down a little bit after that period of time. And China's been driving 50% of Asia's growth, which clearly is amazing. And right now, when you think about comparisons, China is exporting almost as much as Japan. To give you a real estate picture, since 1990, the tallest skyscrapers completed have all been in Asia, all 10 of them. 8 in China. Some pretty amazing real estate, by the way. You know, you're not going to see very many of these in a London, and I'm not going to see many of these in a Chicago. And again, if you just think about growth in the future, what this is showing, that Asia Pacific between the year 2000 and 2030 will grow 92%, with North America in that same period of time growing 30%. You go, well, okay, it's three times North America. But look at the number that it's growing off of. When you think about North America starting with 239 million growing 30%, think about that I guess that would be a trillion, right? It's a number so big I can't keep track of it. But growing at 92%, what you're seeing is there's a huge shift in where real estate is growing around the world. And again, some shocking information to me, 91 cities in the Americas, over a million people, 60 in Europe, and we could probably, if we did a multiple choice game for the next hour, come up with almost all of those because we would have heard of them. But there's 93 in China, and I think we could probably stay here for the next month and not figure that out. There's a whole world out there of real estate that we haven't even seen. So back to that consumption factor, what drives business growth. In just 3 years, China's grown to represent 1/3 of the Asia semiconductor sales, 14% of the semiconductor sales worldwide. By 2008, they'll produce 35% of all the cell phones in the world and 35% of all the personal computers. Now, that's what they're producing. Let's talk about what they're consuming. Their growing middle class is spending $40 billion on electronic products. That was just last year. $40 billion on electronic products last year. And how big is their middle class? More than 100 million consumers. Pretty amazing statistics when you think about where business is going to go. Just a little case study we can look at Volkswagen. Volkswagen clearly figured out the opportunity of China. They have a 40% market share of that market. Their total sales worldwide are expected to grow by 20%, but half of it will come from China. As a result, they're a big part of that foreign direct investment going into that marketplace. So there's much more of a growth in a China than in a Germany relative to their product base. How is that going to make the business world think about where they're going to put their real estate spend go forward? And give you a few more fun statistics. We can look at things like a McDonald's. Someone should probably write the song instead of Pave Paradise. I don't know what McDonald's is doing with his arches, but it's clearly not adding to the pictorial landscape. But they plan to open up over 100 new restaurants. Kentucky Fried Chicken, one new restaurant every 2 days. Clearly a change in the consumer demand and makeup and the real estate environment in Asia. Now, to put it in perspective, when you have that kind of growth and that kind of dynamic, what does it mean for the other parts of the world? And again, just think about this when you start to think about what you're going to be making your long-term decisions in real estate. Tokyo, an incredibly large real estate market, is saying they don't think they're going to see any demand for additional space. What I can tell you is they're building. No question they're building. And then you look at major markets like Singapore and Hong Kong, who actually say, well, we're going to need less space. Now, I predict that the real estate people are going to figure out, and they will do something incredibly adaptive and creative, because they always have. And probably more wealth has been created in Hong Kong for real estate than any other part in the world, so I think they'll prove it again. But it clearly tells you you've got to think about your marketplaces differently. Just a quick little story on a couple of these cities. The first time that I went to Beijing was in 1984, and it was still when you needed a visa to get in, and they were very tight about the visa, and they had just opened a Hyatt. It was the first American hotel allowed into Beijing, and China allowed it on one basis, and that is it had to be built by the Chinese. Now, this is 1984, so we're talking 20 years ago. And we went into the hotel, and you go into the bathroom, and you know, when you go to I guess construction-wise, cut the hole for the sink, which then drops down in there, should be pretty simple, except that the sink in our bathroom sort of had a cut that was like a little 2 inches, a little bit too oblong and open on one side. Not a big detail. And of course, at the other end of the room, the carpet started nice and square, but by the time it got to the other end, it was about this far off in terms of fitting. Now, that was 20 years ago. Look at the picture in the upper left-hand corner. They have nailed it. It didn't take long, okay? So you talk about 20 years of adaptability to go from trying to go from what you'd call sort of the Western civilization expectations of architecture and delivery to where they have a city that gives pride beyond belief to any other city in the world in terms of their real estate. Recently, I was in Shanghai. Shanghai's in another amazing story. If you look at the picture in the upper left-hand corner, that picture is only about 20 years old. The 20-year-after picture is the one in the lower left-hand corner. In 20 years, they have built a city that makes a New York or a London look like a little provincial town. And it's gorgeous. It's got infrastructure and bridges and parks and common areas and some of the most beautiful real estate you'll see in the world. So it just shows you how quickly the real estate world can adapt as you go around the globe. Okay, so I'm now going to switch from the business world over to the investor side, but just real quickly, and going back to the Winning Cities research that our people have done, the corporate market looks at labor market, business environment, infrastructure, lifestyle, innovation, real estate supply, and cost. Some of the factors that we've just gone through. Now let's go to the investor side. The investor's going to look for depth of the market, transparency of the market. They're going to look for the ability to get returns. They're going to look for capital flows and the ability to get capital flows out when they put it in. That's one of the big areas about China. You can get that money in, but can you get it out? They're going to look for risk. They're going to look for supply constraints and opportunities, and they're going to look for real estate demand. There's no question that as you get to the investor world, Asia is up there because it offers growth and productivity, but a lot of other cities around the world still pop up on that chart, and many of those cities are in the U.S. or in Europe. I'm not going to go through that other than to point out there's some pretty crucial factors to real estate success, whether it's technology, the sustainability of a market, the political government, those kind of factors, lifestyle choices, and governance. And Asia, if we use the Jones Lang LaSalle Transparency Index, which measures a lot of are you able to get to that, although it has all these wonderful business factors, when you get to the investor world, it falls pretty low on the transparency capability. So that's a factor when you're thinking about making money as an investment in real estate, as opposed to making money as a business proposition. What's the best way that I can talk about proving that a market is good? It's by turnover. And if you look at this, London is way up there, and I think the comment was one of the top real estate cities in the world. And that's because investors still believe, and they show it in their turnover numbers, which means they're buying real estate today because they think that investment is going to make money for them tomorrow. Clearly, the major markets around the world, in London, in New York, in Paris, and Tokyo, are still way up there. So I can throw all these factors out there and say investors don't care, or I can throw all those factors out there and say investors haven't figured it out. You'll be the next real estate professional, so that's up to you. But the challenge for investors, yes, a new corporate context that they've got to work with. But they still need to think about transparency. They need to think about liquidity, money in, money out, timing. There was mentions of cycles, and I'm going to talk a little bit about cycles in a moment. But these are the things that the investor thinks about. So there's opportunity, but when is it too soon? When is it too late? If there is one change that has happened in my 30 years in real estate, it is that real estate is now mainstream. Real estate was one of those investments you don't want to make because you're going to get in trouble. Then it went to, well, it's an alternative investment. Now it's mainstream. And money is rolling into real estate in ways it never has before. There's been a lot of credibility that's come to the marketplace. Whether you think about the REIT activity or the CMBS activity, the securitization activity, all of that has brought new factors, very good market data, analyst coverage of the industry, rating agencies taking a very, you know, hard look at things and, checks and balance. And probably one of the most significant is a secondary market. Real estate investment was always impacted by the fact it really didn't have good liquidity. Now there's an active secondary market that makes those long-term decisions, at least on the finance side, able to be flexed very quickly. But anyhow, real estate is now mainstream. Look at the returns, 5 years or 10 years. Clearly, it's beat all the other alternatives. If you look at the private real estate, you'll notice it says unleveraged. I'm going to talk about the fact that real estate loves to be leveraged. I guess you use the word gearing here. But it loves to be geared. So if you can get a 10.4% 10-year ungeared return, clearly, this throws it out of the park in terms of all the other alternatives. This happens to be the U.S., but the French and U.K. are exactly the same. Real estate has become mainstream. You've probably studied all this. I don't need to tell you this, but it's the factors that people are looking at, and that is the fact that real estate provides a current return. Most stocks offer modest dividends. Actually, the highest dividends right now are the real estate stocks, the REITs. The rest of the dividends around the world are relatively low. If you go back to those demographic trends that says you're going to have this aging population, matter of fact, it's moving to retirement, what do they want? Cash. They want cash to replace the cash they had as a working population. Real estate offers that. And if you look at returns, again, looking at those long-term returns, again, what everybody figured out is if I don't have to sell that real estate, I'll be just fine. I may have a couple years where if I was marking my portfolio, it would be a problem. But if I don't have to sell it, this is not a bad picture of cash returns and real returns on top of it. Now, hang on to those years, 91, 92, 93, 4, and 5, because I'm going to come back to those. Those are the ones when real estate went backwards, but we'll talk about those in just a little bit. But what you'll see before that and after that, real estate has been just fine. What's happening? Again, it's a real asset. It's beat inflation. Beat inflation, quite honestly, by a long shot. So you get current return, you get hedge against inflation. If you think interest rates are going up and you think inflation's coming back, it makes real estate all the more appealing. And again, to prove it's mainstream, these are investors, whether you think about CalPERS, the largest pension fund in the United States, whether you think about the coal schemes, which I think is, if not the largest, close to the largest pension fund in the UK, when you think about the other ones, a Prudential, and so forth, you'll see that they have a pretty significant weighting, generally, you know, 10 or more, up to 15% weighting in their portfolios of real estate. When I started in the business, again, 30 years ago, GE had 10% in their portfolio. They were the only one in highly critique because the next closest was at 5%. So it wasn't that long ago that pension funds felt that real estate was too risky to have in their portfolios in order to give their retirees benefits. That is clearly changed to the point where you have some that have more than their targeted allocation because they think the opportunity today is so good. So it's mainstream, but can it stay mainstream? That's the cycle question. And really, what is going on in the investment world that might make it change? I talked a little bit earlier about, to me, one of the most dramatic things that has changed is the fact that real estate has figured out how to access public money it's a huge consumer of capital, and if you can get to the public money, that's really what the corporations did that made corporates grow in such a major way. And real estate has now done that. And when you look at the combination of public debt, which is the sort of green, I guess it's more yellow-green, and you look at the public REITs, which is also the other color green, and you start to see that they're contributing 30 to 50% of the money going into real estate, and it's money that was never there before. You start to see about what is happening in terms of what potentially has been driving real estate. Now, I don't think it's going to go away. It clearly is different than it was. Why do I say I don't think it's going to go away? Because this is where the discipline has come from. This is where the analysts come. This is where the rating agencies come. This is where that whole transparency comes. And it really corrects itself pretty quickly. And we've watched it closely in the United States with the REIT activity, which historically would have been significantly overbuilt and corrected itself because they now have that public company ownership. There's more money coming from new sources. I don't know if you have it in the UK, but we have a new phenomenon called private REITs in the United States. And really, they're REITs, but they don't trade actively like they do on the stock market. And they're just throwing money into real estate in a new way with a completely different discipline. So once again, real estate professionals have shown they're incredibly adaptable. They liked the first flow of capital, they went out and got some more. But clearly that's going to drive activity levels. And one of the biggest ways it's driven it, and I know you have the same phenomena in the UK and all across Europe because we see it in our capital markets business here, but the yields, the cap rates have dropped significantly. Typically when you see prices change 20 to 30% in a short period of time, and if you look at it, this has really been in the last 2 years, where you're talking about price changes of that phenomena, you start to worry because, you know, last time the technology stocks did that, it was not sustainable. Is it going to go away? Is this a long-term change in what real estate's going to be valued at? Possibly. We'll talk about interest rates because that's a driving factor. But first, one of the things to me that's interesting, when I look at people paying more, you would think, fundamentals of real estate should be good. Well, if we just look at office, clearly fundamentals of office are not good. And if you go back to last time I said look at those years when the returns of real estate were not good, you'll see that they followed right after the peak of vacancy over in that last time. So the last time we saw something like this, there was a drop in real estate returns. Is it going to be different this time? Just something that needs to be thought about. I have a good friend who's one of the largest apartment developers in the United States, and he said to me that this is the worst fundamentals he's seen in apartments in 25 years, and he says, I'm getting the best prices I've ever had in 25 years. He says, I don't know what's happening, but it feels really good, as he takes his money to the bank. But clearly there's some interesting dynamics of what, is it the money that's driving it, or is there some other factors? I mentioned that one of the things that is very important to real estate is the fact that it's fundamentally thought of as a property that should be geared or leveraged, and it allows the returns to be significantly enhanced. What this chart shows is really that range that you can get by gearing it, and when you can start to talk about returns north of 20 in a marketplace that has interest rates at most bank lines, the Jones Lang LaSalle pays less than 3% for its money. That's a pretty dramatic alternative to all that money not to be chasing this opportunity in a very big way. Interest rates that are really driving all of this, because as we looked at that drop in those prices, what we also see is that the interest rates have dropped at a much more rapid pace. And as we know, if you go back to the gearing and you can get leverage off of property yields against that interest rates, that makes everything work. And if that's a sustainable factor, then there probably has been a permanent change in the valuation of real estate. I have a long enough memory to remember a different time period. Between November of 1980 and September of 1982, the 10-year Treasury never fell below 12%. That's a little different than this chart. As a matter of fact, I remember, and it was in 1981, the 10-year Treasury hit 14.94. There's not much real estate that works when the interest rates are 14.94. And as a matter of fact, there was a 5-year period of time between 1979 and 1984 that the 10-year Treasuries ranged between 12 and 15%. 5 years is a long time of extended high interest rates. So if we have long-term low interest rates, now clearly there's a little blip on what's going on out there. We hope that all of our government's monetary actions will be slight corrections and that will get everything back in line. But clearly the factors around real estate are different today significantly than what they were even, you know, 25 years ago. And 25 years in the history of real estate is a very, very short period of time. So again, going back to looking at the two divergent views of the corporate focus and the investor focus, there are factors to think about. What I would say to you is, if I could sort of summarize, I think it's an incredibly exciting time to be in the real estate industry. It's full of opportunity. It's very nice to be mainstream. And it's nice to be mainstream and performing, which makes everybody very happy. I think the real estate industry is continuing to be innovative, but is actually showing more creativity in a productive way than it has through all my time with it. I think it's very important that real estate will be a solution to the business drives for profits and growth. And how that will all play out is as much a challenge to real estate as it is to just being a company surviving in a global competitive environment. Also, I think there's some major markets for those adventurous enough to want to go to them that are going to have significant opportunities for wealth creation. I know we just celebrated 10 years in China, and our people in China are looking with big glassy eyes that this may be their retirement opportunity as they perform for us in the next coming years. And you know, at the end of the day, there will be winners and there will be losers, but those that think long-term around their decisions, adaptable about how they're going to change if the factors change, definitely will be the winners. And with that, I'm very happy to take questions. Do I push this little?
Thanks very much, Laura Lee, for a fascinating talk. I was thinking, as you were speaking, because you introduced us to a whole range of economic and demographic events that link in with the real estate business, I was thinking what the challenge might be for the sort of the new real estate professionals as they look forward 20 or 30 years, given outsourcing and so on. I was thinking about some of the real estate development here in London, in Canary Wharf. And I guess the challenge is the financial services currently occupying the towers in Canary Wharf are outsourced to India and China. The real challenge will be how to convert those buildings into residential use for the elderly, because they look like they're going to be the major clients for much of the real estate over the next 20 or 30 years in Europe. Anyway, that's an observation from someone who focuses on the economics of aging. There are, of course, many professionals and students of real estate here at LSE and also in Wisconsin, and maybe now we can take some questions. First of all, maybe from LSE, whilst we see if links to Wisconsin actually work.
I just want to ask you about commoditization of markets, because it seems that most markets, when they start out, are very liquid and very profitable. Why do you think real estate is different, or is it different? I mean, is it just going to be another equity market which people start to trade in and then value is eroded? Can you comment on that?
I think the question is, if we just think about real estate as an investment, will it become like any other stock and sort of go to a commodity kind of level? And I think what you're really asking is, there's still room for the entrepreneur and great wealth to be created? Is that probably the add-on question? I think there's really two factors. If you think about the REIT markets, and yes, it's a public market, I'm not sure what, I don't think the UK yet has REITs. They're thinking about it. In the United States, in the equity REIT marketplace has been pretty active since the mid-90s. It still only provides about 15% of the capital to the real estate marketplace. So it's a relatively small piece of that activity. Now, what it does do is it creates a fair amount of benchmarking and transparency, but it picks a certain category of product that it works in. And all around that, there's all sorts of creativity going on in spaces that it doesn't choose to occupy. So in many cases, it's driven those other parts of the market, and that's why I go back to, I think real estate professionals show amazing adaptability, that the second something goes to a commodity, they figure out how to drive and find the wealth someplace else. You know, same thing happened with CMBS. One could argue that the actual CMBS, that's the mortgage debt that is now in a security form, that's a very commoditized form of financing, and it is. But what real estate has figured out what to do with that debt to create tremendous value in other places has shown great adaptability. So I think it's playing on those edges. There's always commodity aspects to every industry. Business has that. But there's always lots of room for innovation. And I think it's the intellect that really makes the difference to where wealth is created.
Shall we now see if in our globalized world we can make contact with Wisconsin and take any questions that you may have?
I have been told that it should work.
Hello, we're hearing you. Go ahead.
What sort of barriers to entry are being faced in these emerging markets for outside capital?
I'm not sure you heard that.
Could you repeat the question, please?
Sure, the barriers to entry are foreign investors. I assume there are limits to property ownership and issues like that.
I'm afraid to say the line has broken down from Wisconsin to here. We'll try it again in after another question from LSE, but I'm afraid we couldn't hear you clearly.
When you say 10% investment of real estate in a well-diversified portfolio, do you see the real estate as a direct investment into the real estate property as such, or REITs as an equity investment? Because there's a notion that saying REITs are now an asset class even by itself, although within the real estate sort of, do you know?
I think you're referring to the slide that I showed that showed a number of large investors at CalPERS and Kohl's schemes. Those actually happen to be clients of Jones Lang LaSalle, so I know them quite well. And what we would tell you is if the $24 billion that we manage around the globe for institutions, $4 billion of it's in REITs, and $20 billion of it is direct into real estate. And what we're seeing is that, I guess it goes back to the commodity kind of nature answered earlier, the institutions that have decided to put a healthy allocation into real estate believe more money will be made in direct real estate than into the securities, because they're going to manage themselves to sort of a certain level of performance. So of those pension funds, it still is principally into direct real estate.
Okay, shall we try one more time with a link to Wisconsin and a question from Wisconsin, please?
Assuming you hear me, let me first tell you that we hear you extremely well, and the only problem is with the feedback of our sound, so we didn't lose anything from what you said. And if I could try one question, do you have a sense of what's happening to the real estate markets in countries like India, in the cities which have attracted a lot of foreign capital?
I heard India and growing in capital. Was the question, are people investing capital into India? Was that the question?
No. Is India becoming more expensive in terms of real estate?
Oh, is India becoming more expensive in terms of real estate? The interesting thing to me about India is real estate's not cheap. As a matter of fact, it's fairly comparable to what we find in you know, most of the, you know, probably not central London, but outside London or in the markets outside the United States. What they do is they use it very efficiently. As I mentioned, Accenture doing 3 shifts a day. And they have a very inexpensive labor force. And it's a labor force that will accept 3 shifts a day, because they're thrilled to have jobs. You know, if you put those same real estate working conditions on most US or UK or European businesses, and I know we've seen many corporates try that, the employees will quit and go to work someplace else. They still either want their own office, or they want their own private open space where they can hang a picture of their family and leave their possessions there permanently locked in their drawer. And you know, when I walked over through the facility in Bangalore that we're managing, there's no personal identity whatsoever. There's a lot of people tramping in and tramping out. So they're using their very expensive real estate in a very adaptive way. I think the other thing about India, and I find it fairly terrorizing, but they don't, and that is the infrastructure is so poor. You know, power outages, they all have backup generators. The roads and transportation systems are really very unaccommodating. And housing is, for expats, very expensive if you want anything that's of a quality, or really pretty poor outside of that. So it has its challenges. I think that's why China is more interesting, because China has built the infrastructure. And is prepared to build more infrastructure, which India really hasn't proven to do yet. But on the other hand, China's real estate's pretty expensive also. So these are not markets where real estate is cheap. These are markets where labor is very cheap. And I think the long-term argument is that it will equalize. The question is just how quickly, because it's such a huge gap that it's got to close. You know, I'm being from Wisconsin, I'm sure you're aware the small towns in Wisconsin haven't closed the gap on a Milwaukee or Chicago, and that's a long time. So I'm not sure how quickly that will close, but the real estate gap was closed before it started. Yes.
This is building slightly on what you were just saying, but you were talking about how China does have the infrastructure developed, and also from your slides it looks like it's very rapidly growing and probably a very good place to invest in by the way you're presenting it. Could you elaborate on why some of your clients and a lot of the investing is still being done in major North American cities and European ones versus your Asia, and where when you see a transition and if you see a transition coming?
I think that's an excellent question. It's really that transition of, at this point, what is good for business and then what is good for the investor. I mentioned Jones Lang LaSalle's been in China for 10 years. We make money in China. We managed for the first time this last year to get some cash out. The China government is not yet prepared to let, they're very prepared for money to go in. They're very controlling about the money that's going to go out. If you go back to that transparency index, I mean, one of the things that an investor wants to know is, if I make a lot of money, am I going to be able to get it? You know, in my experience, for example, you know, let's take a Latin America. At my previous employment, we had put money in Brazil. It took us 8 years to get the money out of Brazil. So, you know, those kind of things make it very difficult to think about your investment opportunities. That being said, China knows it. And they will start addressing it quickly, and they just have to decide how they want to do it. You know, they're putting a lot of regulations now around their banking so that it's viewed as more robust in terms of its risk management and its disciplines. And you know, it will get the rest of those things together, but it's going to do it at its pace. And at the moment, it's got a wealth of capital going in, very happy to go in there and stay. Because again, if you go back to those consumer dynamics of that middle class in China, very prepared to spend, Volkswagen go in, sell half their cars in China, they don't have to pull that money out. But they, at some point in time, they'll want to. But the investor has a different issue. That being said, I know that we just recently raised the second tranche of an Asia Recovery Fund. The first one is now fully invested. This is LaSalle Investment Management, which is our money management arm of Jones Lang LaSalle. And in our prospectus, we did say that we anticipate that part of that money will go into China with this next round, because you're starting to see some of that opening up. But that's been the big block.
Just to add to that, I guess standard portfolio theory would tell us that you don't always chase the highest return. You go for a balanced portfolio with appropriate spread of risk. So hence investment across many different markets. Another question.
Yeah, it's kind of like a two-part question. The first part is, would you agree that investors in North America and Europe require a premium for investing in faraway places which they don't know much about the market? And if that is yes, is there that premium available in places like China and India and other countries like that?
The question on premium anywhere is, if there's more risk, then investors, yes, they want a premium. And at this point in time, Asia is viewed as having more risk. Right now, again, I'll go back to Jones Lang LaSalle, we're in the middle of three different capital raises for investments. One's in Europe, it's targeting 12 to 14% leveraged returns. One's in the United States, targeting something just a touch lower than that. And the Asia Recovery Fund is targeting 20 or more returns. And the first invested capital in the first one is going to produce returns that are closer to 30% because of that risk. And that money didn't go into China. That money went into Japan and Korea and Thailand and Hong Kong. Still, even in some of those more transparent markets of Asia, it still needs a risk premium.
Should we turn to our friends in Wisconsin again to see if we can take another question from you?
Other than the difficulty of getting capital out of the countries, what sort of barriers to entry are foreign investors facing in these emerging markets?
I got that very end. What was the very beginning then?
Barriers to entry in emerging markets.
Oh, barrier to entry in the American markets or the Asian markets? Or the emerging markets?
Emerging market, Asian.
Yeah, I think it's a question of what type of barriers. Let's just talk about doing business. China, for example, every single activity that we do as Zhongzheng LaSalle in China needs a special license. And you kind of go, well, but why do they want a special license? Because they get a fee. So we have licenses, you know, we do all these things. In other places, we just, you know, go into doing business, but we need a license for everything. And then they limit it so that you have to pay more for those and also protect the local markets. So there's those kind of regulations. I would say the other barrier to entry, and it's probably the biggest one that real estate always faces, and that is really the legal aspects, you know, getting title to property, what are your rights and remedies in terms of something not going well. You can get very spoiled in UK or US law because the property owner has lots of legal protections around that, and you know, you can get, you know, you have title and all the, it's a different space over there in terms of that legal barrier. So I would say that's probably the second biggest. So there's, it's doing business. Even if you go back to China, in many places what they want is you have to have a local partner that's a front person. It's again a way, it's a, for a fee to go to somebody in China. It's all about money being transferred in some way, shape, or form to somebody else. So it is a different way of doing business. What we found is that as we go into emerging markets, we do a blend of two things. We do first we go in with expats and then hire locally, because we want the combination of the local cultures together with the expat that knows our ethics and standards. And then as we mature those operations, we will transfer the leadership into the local countries. So for example, we have a national that runs Japan, Thailand, Korea, Singapore, but we still have expats in China and India. However, we've just recently in our third office in China have put a national in to run that smaller office. So it's the ethics of doing business as well.
I was just wondering, looking at the, going back to the pension funds, looking at CalPERS, and you showed sort of a between 10 and I think 15 in a Canadian pension fund, and then looking at the risk return that we've seen recently, do you think that it's irrationally low, the amount that they're putting into property, and how do you see that progressing?
I'm probably not the best person to answer that, but you know, there has been an increase in real estate allocations. I think one of the things that the longer-term investors in real estate out of the institutions are concerned about, and CalPERS has been in real estate for a long term, is the recent shift in values. And I can tell you all of them that are what I would say known real estate investors are fairly troubled by that valuation drop. And so there's been a little bit of holdback. Versus there's been a lot of growth in some of the pension funds that have never been in real estate before. Looks very attractive, just like the dot-coms did. So you're getting a mixture, and I guess, you know, one of the things about being in real estate a long time and having gone through cycles is you have this sort of sick feeling in your stomach all the time that you never know when the next cycle is going to come. I think CalPERS is potentially one of those, though I will tell you they're very astute. They recently have now taken money out of the U.S. Their money had always been only invested in real estate in the United States. And we just took them to Mexico and bought a portfolio with them and also some investors out of Canada, such that they're now the largest owner of industrial property in Mexico. But that was a big change for them. And they did it principally because they could get they could invest in Mexico the way they had historically invested in the United States. Now, whether you know that is going to be something that changes in the future, I think we'll have to be seen.
Let's try to go to Wisconsin again to ask you if you have any further questions.
I have a question about outsourcing. Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that over the long run, increases in trade are associated with increases in productivity and standard of living. Many of the discussions we hear about outsourcing today are much more negative. Do you have any view on whether outsourcing is more or less similar to increases that we've seen in the past in traditional imports and exports, or is there something new about this?
I think outsourcing is probably a good proxy for what we've seen in other parts of transitions of the way people do business. The cost of labor is cheaper in an India marketplace, but what you really see is that companies like an Accenture, like a Fidelity, like the Convergys, have taken it and have put in tremendous process and controls. And at the end of the day, even if you talk to them, meaning those companies, they say we're getting to the point where we're somewhat impartial whether we move it to in India or we in fact put the productivity changes that we've developed into something closer to home. Because there's many companies that are uncomfortable with actually offshoring to some markets that they view as less friendly or higher risk. You know, what we find in our business when it's outsourced to us, it's real estate, so we can't move it to India. And what really happens is it's all about the disciplines of process, metricing, and measuring. And that's probably the biggest change that's coming to business, just really globally. Technology forces it, transparency forces it. What I've always said is the greatest fortunes have been made by arbitrage, which is really, I know something that you don't. And disciplines take the arbitrage out of things. That's why, going back to the question on REITs and some of those, when you take the arbitrage out, the returns go down. So I think processes and best practices will take a lot of the arbitrage out of what's happening in India, but they have such good disciplines that I think even if their costs start to move up higher, what you're hearing from many corporates is that the quality coming out of the work is such that they would pay a higher price for it, and that's really that discipline.
I think we are now approaching the end of our time, so this perhaps better be the last question. Thank you.
I'd like you to shed a little light on the Japanese market, which reached a crescendo in about the late 80s, when the real estate value of Tokyo, metropolitan Tokyo, was more than the real estate value of continental United States. And since then, it's fallen about 80%. Yields in that market are still very attractive, as you know, about 6%. And the cost of money is very, very low. So a lot of professional investors have made some major investments there which haven't panned out. Do you think they will, in view of the changing demographic scenario?
Japan is an interesting topic for me. I spent 15 years working for Heller Financial, and at the beginning we were owned by Fuji Bank out of Tokyo, and at the end they were our largest shareholder after we went public. And I watched Fuji Bank go from AAA when it was, you know, the number two bank in the world when real estate was at its peak, and watched it drop to the point where it could barely hold its investment grade because so much of its business had been destroyed by the falling real estate values. The interesting thing is, as a U.S. visitor to Tokyo, even back then, I would look at it and say, there's cranes everywhere. This real estate market is not going to last. And when you looked at the fundamentals, 80 to 90% of a building value was the land cost. You were paying a very sliver for the utilitarian practical side of the real estate, which would be the cash flows coming off the leases of the business. And yet, so you would say land is very precious, except that you could see low rises everywhere that could easily be leveled, which they did to build high rises. Land wasn't at a premium, but they had convinced themselves that it was. So it was one of those, you know, I think it was, you know, going back to a tulip craze that wasn't real. And I think any time the economics go out of anything, it's going to have issues. The other challenge, and this goes back to the earlier question on sort of barriers, the real challenge for correcting the Japanese market was that the loans against the real estate were never made to the real estate. They were made to corporations and individuals who said, here's my balance sheet with all these assets. And so when the banks wanted to do something, they couldn't foreclose and take the real estate back. So there wasn't a way that normally happens in a marketplace to correct it. You couldn't securitize or anything because you could not get title to the real estate. It was connected with spaghetti in major ways where you had to do a major restructuring with the borrower over 40 or 50 assets in many cases and didn't know how to correct it. And bankruptcy is not a really good concept in Japan. So you didn't have that to sort of correct. And on top of that, the banks had an issue because the government, if they wrote the loans down, wouldn't let them have a tax shelter. So if you think about something being a loss, at least in the U.S., you say, well, it's not really that big because part of it the government's going to give me a credit for. Japan was terrible. You took the whole loss and got no tax credit. So they had all sorts of fundamentals that just didn't work for real estate. A lot of what has come out of that is they finally have sort of sorted out that spaghetti. And I think it's because most of the big Japanese banks had big positions in the United States, had opened up real estate arms here, and had learned a lot. And I know I spent a lot of time in Japan actually giving advice to our colleagues there on possible solutions around real estate to correct it. So, but today, lots of money is being made again in many parts of real estate in Japan. And yes, it's only a 5 or 6% yield, but then again, interest rate is 0.0001. So there's still a nice arbitrage in real estate works.
Laura Lee, thank you very, very much indeed for a fascinating lecture. With a tremendous range across the world, as appropriate for a globalizing real estate industry. You've touched on developments just now in Tokyo, in China, in India, in the United States, and in Europe. And you've also, for an audience here at the London School of Economics and in Wisconsin, you've brought the detailed issues of the real estate industry to connect with some of the more general social and economic trends that we're facing in the world over the next 20 to 30 years. A lot to think about, especially for people about to enter into the real estate industry as new professionals. A lot to think about, no doubt, for some of the, I shouldn't say old professionals, established professionals already in the industry. In fact, if I could have my time again, I think rather than focus on the subject of economic history, I would, after your talk, be quite tempted to enter into the world of real estate. And especially so, since every real estate operator, developer that I know of is extremely wealthy, and almost every historian I know is extremely poor. There could be no better reason, I think, for launching into a career in real estate. Laura Lee Martin, thanks very much.